In today's podcast, we explore how we can teach mindfulness in the classroom. Lynn van der Hoff sits down with Jenny Canu, Ingrid Pina, and myself, Kaylin Sondrup, to really unpack what mindfulness is, how we can develop a practice of our own if we don't already have one, and most importantly, what strategies actually work when it comes to teaching kids and teens mindfulness. We start off by interviewing Jenny Canu, who is the co-founder and director of Mindfulness Africa and facilitates mindfulness, compassion, and insight courses, talks, and workshops all across Cape Town. Jenny has pioneered mindfulness in education by making mindfulness accessible to teachers and educators. And we're so grateful to have her on this podcast. Let's dive in.
So one of the first questions I want to ask you is that with all these years of experience as a mindfulness practitioner and your extensive work with teachers and NGOs, can you just very briefly summarize your work for us and why you believe it can be of value in the classroom?
I'm quite struck by your words and the sentiment that you have. And I think it's exactly that. It's about compassion-based mindfulness. It's about growing our awareness and treating ourselves with kindness. And a wonderful definition for compassion-based mindfulness is our ability to be with things as they are, to be with ourselves as we are, to be with things as they are, in an open and kind way. I just want to say that right now, I'm feeling quite groggy. I've got a cold coming on, and I'm really not feeling wonderful. I want to be here and express myself in a very coherent and wonderful way. But at the same time, just being aware of that and not being in conflict with how my body's feeling, my mind's feeling, and bringing kindness to myself in this very moment. The big insight for me is that it's not really the experience that we're having that's important, but how we're relating to it. So if you think about it, we have this internal dialogue 24/7 inside our own minds. What does that look like? When we tend to experience a positive, or what we consider a positive experience, if you're anything like me, you grasp onto it, and you want to ride that feeling out, that mood out, you know. So if I'm having a good Tuesday, I want to carry this through to the weekend and even, you know, on and on. And this causes deep suffering because that moment's passed. And in the same way, when we're experiencing difficulty, there's a natural tendency for all of us. You know, we don't want to experience the discomfort. We want to push it away. We want to suppress it. And that causes a lot of inner conflict. So it's this capacity to be really truthful and authentic with what's going on, have that awareness. And in the moment, bring kindness. And that's probably the most important part, is really to be kind to ourselves, to soothe ourselves, and to help us get through, you know, whatever we're experiencing. This ability to be with things, that really developing awareness, but also that kindness so that we can get through things. People always say, how do you get over something? Well, you've got to go through it. But if you go through it and you support yourself.
And I find that notion of compassion or kindness fascinating, because I can see it transferring into a school environment. How would you see it? How would you see mindfulness, compassion-based mindfulness being used in a school?
I'm just relating to this question on a personal level. I have been an educator for the best part of my life, firstly as a human rights lecturer, and then just teaching mindfulness and compassion for the last decade, and teaching it to various groups, from young children to teenagers to adults, and myself learning as I'm going. My heart really goes out to teachers. When you want to make a teaching point, it's so, so difficult. Dealing with, you know, 20, 30 students at a time, you know, I mean, it must be one of the most difficult jobs in the world. So I really relate to that and what that can bring up. We never teach children how to be calm, how to be focused. We expect this of them. You know, this is where it can get very tricky, because this is a skill that we need to grow and we need to develop in our children and develop in ourselves. Just to know that the nervous system takes 24 years to develop. So children aren't able to just be calm and be focused when someone wants to make a teaching point. So as teachers, we've got to embody this for ourselves, because we teach through who we are. So if we are in that moment able to do this very thing where we ourselves calm down, we ourselves gain focus, and then reconnect with who we're teaching so that we can actually have a teaching moment. So it becomes the most important part of a teaching environment is the atmosphere that the teacher creates. So it's really this type of deep personal qualities that really makes a difference in how one teaches. Because it's not the information that's being passed on. It's how you teach, the tone that you teach with, your capacity to be connected and tuned into the classroom. That means you've got to be able to have a certain level of an ability to self-regulate, an ability to know what's going on for yourself inwardly and outwardly, and to take care of yourself in that moment. So it's very, very relevant. It's very exciting to work with teachers because they really do need it.
I think this issue of modeling for children in the class is so true, but as you're saying, so very difficult in the moment.
Yeah.
So how, Jenny, could the practice of mindfulness be applied in a classroom?
Because we are sensory beings. We've got so many mirror neurons in our bodies, which informs our brains. And so we pick up and we resonate with how people are feeling. And with a teacher, especially who's a person of authority, who's a person who's going to set the pace for the day, we can, as children or anybody, can pick up how that person's feeling. Now, if the teacher is not going to deal with it, the children have to deal with it. It's unsaid. It's a tension that resides there through the day. But if the teacher actually takes a moment to soothe herself and takes that moment as a teaching moment, then, you know, everyone releases and relaxes. And you can do that for yourself as a teacher by just taking a moment. So a practical example are the self-soothing practices that one can do. There are several, like for instance, our breath. You know, we take this so for granted, but we have a natural intelligence with our breath. So in that moment, reflect on your state of mind. Your breathing always will show you your state of mind. You know, so when you're worried or when you're anxious, your breathing will indicate that. It'll be quite shallow, it can be quite sharp. And then taking those soothing deep breaths, there's a whole science again around deep breathing. And it's about the only thing that we can actually control and regulate. So very deep breathing in a way that is intuitively soothing for you. Just taking those moments to take deep inhalations in and out. And I do that as a mom at home as well, and I'll stop breathing deeply, and then my kids will start breathing deeply with me, and we'll have a good giggle. And it's just a way of calming our nervous system, and it's so easy. So the teacher in that situation can just start embracing these deeper breaths, and the kids always pick up, and they love to imitate and to do things and so forth. And so she can also orientate everyone else in that moment, like, oh, let's just take some nice deep breaths and so forth. So there's so much that can be done in that moment to just be with our emotions. And this is an important part, is that we're not trying to get rid of the emotions. We're not trying to, any situation where we are now trying to get rid of something will put us in conflict. So it's almost like accepting and welcoming the fact that I might be groggy right now, I might not be at my best right now, but it's okay. So that's the kind of inward process that's happening, but it's also an outward process because everyone around us is actually really feeling it. And that can happen at any time in the class. There's a dynamic happening and the teacher picks up on it and the teacher says, right, let's do some mindful movement. Let's do some mindful breathing. Let's do a mindfulness soothing exercise. So what happens is that children have a natural ability then to learn to embody this and to practice this. And then they start to learn how to self-regulate, which is actually what an inherent capacity that they have, but now it becomes conscious, and we do it in the classroom. So it's just, it's very, very tangible. It's something that's very doable. It's just a matter of us really looking at it in a very natural way, what's needed in this moment as it's unfolding. And we can become very creative in a situation like that.
Wonderful. I love that idea of a teacher modeling self-regulation, and both emotional and yeah, physical self-regulation. Mm. Do you need to expand it a little out of that moment in the classroom? Could I ask you, if we look at a whole school level, what would a mindful school look like, feel like, and how would it actually operate?
Having worked with schools, I would say that the most important part of it is to think about it as an ethic, a school ethic. You know, speak to the school principal, speak to the teachers, and see what are the ethics, what do they want to promote? You know, and this is about promoting awareness of self and other and the kindness aspect. And can sit so well, can fit so well with how a school grows. In fact, I just wanted to say that the Dalai Lama at the moment has just released, they've been working on this with Emory University for the last, I think, 15 years, a free curriculum that deals not only with social emotional intelligence, but with ethics. And this is something you can download, the teachers can work with, that, you know, schools can work with. It's out there, it's free, and it's available for teachers and for schools. So that has to become an ethic for a school. Then it's about really creating a safe, holistic environment where teachers feel safe in who they are, feel that it's an environment that is supportive, feel that you're part of a team, that the school is actually investing in them and in who they are, including their mental health. And that is such a supportive environment. And if you've got that as an ethic, and if you've got that as an environment, then the children, of course, are going to benefit from it, because the school's investing in the teachers in a very profound way. So, and the teachers would invest in the children in a very profound way. So, you know, when you're having an assembly, start off the assembly with a few moments of mindfulness, which just basically means arrive where you are. We're all coming in with different notions of what's happening for the day and so forth. Let's take a few moments to breathe in, just acclimatize where we are, we're here. And it just brings everyone onto the same ground. So it's so helpful for all of us. Teachers could start off their day with sensing, connecting to how we're all feeling in this moment. What should we be doing here? It's an organic process. It's that, what's happening right now? What do we need right now? Maybe we need to breathe a little bit together. Maybe we just need to do a check-in together. Maybe we do some exercises together. It's that kind of we're there to care for each other and to be supportive. What's also really inspired me recently is the science around how we learn. And if you think about the technological age, we are now so invested in this age of information. And I see schools moving so much into, you've got to have your iPad, you've got to have your computer here and so forth. But with anything in life, you've got to have that sense of balance. And the most exciting thing that I've heard of recently is a study that's been conducted, and I think it was only recently in 2019, where they've looked at when children develop language. And I think it's between age 6 months and 12 months. And what they've done is a study where they've had a teacher speaking Mandarin to English-speaking children for, let's say, 12 sessions. So she's interacting, she's making eye contact, and she's teaching them. She's just talking a different language for, let's say, 12 sessions. Then you've got another group of children in exactly the same circumstances, exactly the same setting, but this time you've got her on video speaking Mandarin. And what they found is that the children who had the interaction, the human interaction, which includes presence, which includes eye contact, learned Mandarin. Whereas the children that were on video were very engaged. They were looking at the video, but they didn't learn or pick up the language. So this brings us to how we learn, and I'm learning about this, and neuroscientists are learning about this and saying that we've got this prefrontal cortex that is the analytical brain that can go there, but we've got another thing called the social brain, different parts of the brain, which happens when we're around each other, because we learn more deeply when we are truly connected, when we've got eye-to-eye contact, when we can feel each other's presence, because we're reading. What's happening here is that when we're learning with a social brain, you're taking in things so much more because you're taking it in context. You're learning in context. You're learning how it relates to you, and you're learning through others. It really enhances the learning process. So what the fMRIs are showing is that there's a sensitivity that is not triggered in the brain when you're watching a video. It does not trigger in the brain. Whereas a certain level of sensitivity, which is in our social brain, is triggered when you are in life presence. So if you think of that in relation to a classroom, it's all about eye contact. That's how we learn the most. When you really want to learn from someone, you'll see, you'll find yourself really engaging and that, you know, with that person in terms of eye contact, we're doing it right now, you know, and that person's body language, it's giving you such a context of what's happening. So it's so important to have that as part of learning. So for instance, in a school, you would get children to learn through eye contact, smaller groups, get them sitting together. The normal model is, I'm this teacher and I'm going to pass down information to you, and you, this vessel, that's just going to take in information. Whereas if children are encouraged to work together in groups and so forth, it is highly beneficial because they are connecting with that social brain that really helps the learning process on another level. It's not just intellectual and cold. So this is now the new science that's coming on and saying, we need to have live transmission. We need to be together. So if you're going to do anything in mindfulness, I would suggest that you, if you're practicing presence and awareness, that you actually do it in a live context, that you actually go to experience it in a live way.
Which brings me on to the next question. Yes. Because I have this vision of teachers in assembly having their moment of silence, of obviously connecting with children in their classroom and trying to do it mindfully. What I'd like to ask you is that teachers listen to this. Some might have their own mindful practice. Others might be neutral about mindfulness. And still others might be really skeptical about it. So if I was a teacher that had done no mindfulness training, but was interested in implementing mindfulness in the classroom, what would I do?
Okay, so with regards to this question, I will just base it on my experience. And my experience has been a teacher who came attended one of my courses, and it made a very big difference to her life. So the way, when you derive benefit from something, you tend to share it. She obviously felt better, and she's very energized and went back to school, and everyone's like, what's happening, and so forth. And she had that conversation with the school principal. And through that way, then organized a workshop, organized teachers to come. I think it just developed kind of organically like that. I had this chance to present to the whole school, you know, to the faculty. And it was wonderful because we had the sense of just exploring it, you know, in a conversation and making it relatable, allowing people to flow, to ask questions. And I think that's with anything else, you know, if you're curious, if it's relatable, you've got an interest. And that's the only time this will work, is if there is an interest. And that's what happened in the school environment. Teachers were very keen. And luckily in that school environment, they had the funds and the school had that ability to support the teachers and invest the teachers. So that's one way to go about it. If there are school funds and the school wants to take it on as an ethos and to bring it into the school, that's one way of doing it. The second way is just to look at the variety of organizations or institutions that are there. I myself have worked through NAPTOSA, which is a teacher training organization. They do amazing work. They're also sponsored by the government. And you can really do courses there at really low cost. And the wonderful thing there is that you are getting together with other teachers from very different environments. So we've held some courses through NAPTOSA. And then just to look around, I would say definitely to see what's suitable for you. And my notion of it is that people should trust themselves, you know. Look at what's out there, do some research. So easy these days to access information, what courses are out there. But the main thing I would say is look for someone who you can listen to or hear or you read about them. They should have experience because it's a capacity. So the person's experience is really important. To have experience, and then just look at ways of doing it for oneself, if there isn't that support, you know, in terms of other institutions and so forth. And I think this is also the important point of there's so much going online, and I think that plays an important role because some people just don't have access. If you think of someone in the rural area or someone, you know, who just doesn't have access to courses, that plays an important part, and I'd say go for it. But just coming back to the previous conversation, you know, when we were talking about social learning, it's so important if you're going to learn presence that you learn it through others, through practicing presence, being present with others. So many, many options. But just to trust yourself and do it intuitively and to know that there's no right way. You know, it's just, you know, with these things, we just really trust ourselves and we're on a journey and just explore it and be curious about what's potentially out there. But in South Africa, there's quite a lot going on. So it's quite exciting, quite a lot of opportunities.
So you're really saying that to be able to work with children or teens, mindful practices, you need to have a true felt experience of the work yourself, understand yourself and the ethos of mindfulness, the integrity of it before you.
Yes, but you know, having said that, Lynn, if you think about it, people have that naturally too, through life's experience. We've already all got it, so we need to know that, you know what, we're enhancing in a capacity that we've got. You know, when I'm teaching children and to make it relatable, I'd say, right, you are about to get, you know, what do you love to do? And some will say cricket or soccer or this or that. I say, right, now, when you're about to play soccer and then you hear the ice cream bell ring, yeah, and your mind goes there, right? Are you still able to kick that soccer ball? Probably. Can you still kick it very well? Probably not. Why? Your mind's somewhere else, right? Now, so mindfulness is the ability to recognize that the ice cream bell's going off. I like it. I wish I had an ice cream. But to bring it right back to that present moment, what's unfolding? I need to kick this ball forward and into that goalpost. And that's a natural capacity some of us have. Some of us have to work on it a bit. I'm one of those. I've had to work on it a lot. Just who I am. I'm always growing and needing to develop this capacity more and more. But inherently, we have it. And it's a wonderful notion to know that we do have it already, although we can formally train in developing this capacity more, which enhances every aspect of our lives because we can communicate better. We can teach better, you know, in that sense of when we're present, we're able to do things better. So, you know, what I always say, our capacity to do anything well depends on our level of mindfulness, you know, to be with things as they really are.
Isn't that a lovely link between the normal teaching of academics and results and that more human capacity and development?
Absolutely. And if you look at, yeah, again, you know, if you look at what subject did you love, most of the time it was related to the person who you related to was teaching that subject.
So, Jenny, I love the idea that everybody has an innate ability to be mindful. But to go back to an earlier question about teachers who didn't have the mindfulness practice and what they would do, what about teachers who have done their mindfulness training but now want to work with children? What would you suggest?
So we don't need to reinvent the wheel. And there's so many curricula out there already which are age-appropriate. So there's Mindful Schools, there's Mind Up, there's Pause B. There's so many curriculum out there that teachers can work with. You know, so it's if you're teaching grade 4 children, you'll teach it in, you know, with short moments of awareness, for instance. And the language you use, the exercises you use will be age appropriate. And just to say that there are many, many programs out there that are for free. As I mentioned, the SEE learning, which is the social, emotional, and ethical learning. And it's wonderful because it's based on this very notion that I was talking about in the beginning around kindness. That is ethically and morally what all religious, spiritual, and wisdom practices in the world, that's the foundation, you know, is kindness. You know, you find it everywhere, and it's kind of the glue that keeps it all together. So, yeah, so teachers can look at curriculum. You can have someone who is specialized in teaching curriculum come into your school and help you. I've done that as well. You know, coming in and saying, right, I can teach curriculum from grade 1 to grade 10 and work with the different teachers. And otherwise, teachers can download a program that's for free so they can start working with their own practice and seeing what's relevant for them, because you'll only do what you find beneficial. Ultimately, what's helpful for you is your way of, you know, of bringing it into the classroom. Another way to kind of build community is then to bring it into with the parents. And I found this so helpful because it's all about community. So if you're going to think of a school, if you're going to think of teachers, the parents are part of that. And as teachers, we need to hold hands, with the parents and the student, because we never just teach a child. You know, you're holding a family, which I think is so, which is really what is so complex around teaching. But we can make that an enhancing factor, where we can also provide, a school environment can also provide workshops for parents who are interested, so that you feel that there's a community that's building around this ethos of compassion-based mindfulness.
Jenny, that's just a lovely, holistic way of looking at mindfulness. But I do have to ask the difficult question as well, of when is mindfulness not appropriate, or mindfulness practices not appropriate?
I think it's fabulous, because we, again, it's all about self-awareness, right, and being authentic. And actually knowing when we're not in a good space to undertake things. So, you know, this is an educational program. And it's very important that when we are going through, you know, life's challenges, when we're going through an emotional crisis, that we seek the appropriate help. So there I would say go and find the inner resources and outer resources. It's about seeking out help from your community, from your friends, from people who care for you, that can be there. And also, you know, considering counseling, considering therapy and more one-on-one, because you're in need of that. You know, these courses are educational and they're wonderful, but you're going to be in a group setting. You know, so we always do work with this very delicately. And so there are many different modalities. And that's why I say one should be honest and one should kind of intuit what's really needed.
And to be aware of the emotional space the children are in and traumas they have experienced, because I think that is a very...
Absolutely. And, you know, these days there's so much that's come out on being trauma-informed. You know, and it's so much part of what we all needing to know.
I think we have classrooms today, especially in South Africa, where so many children have experienced trauma or who are experiencing some level of depression or anxiety. How would one manage mindful practices with those children?
Again, I think through experience, being sensitive, coming back to our own kind of struggles, because we all go through so much, being really honest about ourselves, working with ourselves, so it's not always out there and someone else that's having issues, but so we can relate in that way, that's sensitive. But I think practices these days, especially around mindfulness, have changed so and adapted to all this information that's coming around being trauma-informed. So, for instance, a child might not feel safe closing their eyes to do a practice, you know, because that they could embody or have memories that are difficult for them and so forth. So it's very important, for instance, to be sensitive to that and to know that. So when I teach children, for sure, it's all about eyes open and being here and being now. And so, you know, one looks at this through trauma-informed practices and awareness, and a teacher can keep learning, I think, almost organically as well. You know, you get in touch with and you keep connecting with children as to where they are, and then making those practices sensitive to what's going on. But at the same time, you know, just to express to you that I've had this wonderful opportunity for the last almost decade to work with an NGO called Life Choices. And they run amazing programs throughout the Cape Flats in the more impoverished areas. And so I come across children whose conditions, living conditions, are not going to change. And the living conditions are quite dire. But this does not, and this is the amazing thing, it does not distract from their ability and their willingness to learn. So when I come in there and I'm teaching, and sometimes, you know, I'm teaching 100 children at a time or whatever, there's no wonderful seating arrangements or a quiet environment or anything like that. that we just, you know, it's all about being with things as they are. And this has been such a growth spurt for me too, to understanding how I can help and where, you know, and children can help. And it's a synergy that develops. And what I want to say to you there is that my experience over the last 10 years working with children in impoverished environments and coming from situations where there has and is continuing trauma and difficulty, is that these children come in and the kindness aspect is what really sits with them, you know? To not only realize what's going on in their minds, become aware of what's going on, but that they can hold themselves with kindness, that they can soothe themselves in any given moment. That for them is golden, you know? And also another way to adapt, for instance, a mindfulness practice, which I find has been very beneficial, is to teach mindfulness of sound. So with most of these children, they are in environments where they are learning and sleeping in places where they have no privacy and they don't have a quiet space to go and learn. So teaching them to become aware of sound as an anchor to be present, you know, to learn to be with sounds and noises as they are, really allows them to relax around sounds, to relax around noise, and focus and still be attentive and still be able to learn. And this is amazing because they themselves, you know, the feedback is that, wow, I have this amazing capacity to learn and this is what I do, and they go for it. And the feedback over years and years, because we look at and we do questions, you know, with the kids and feedback as to, you know, before and after the 8-week courses. And most of them will talk about two important things. The first one is that most of them improve their marks because they know what to do. Because I also teach, and I think this is so relevant, about how your brain works, you know, how you learn. And that is so empowering when you know how to, you know, how your brain is learning, how it's taking in information, how to soothe yourself, how to enhance your focus and attention, which is all the qualities of the mind that you need to learn. Kids run with it. They love it, you know. And so they improve. They can see themselves improving, you know, in their marks. I teach a lot to matric students, and it's so helpful for them. And that's the feedback, but what really comes out again is the kindness. Oh, wow, I didn't realize that I've got so much going on and I've got this inner critic and I don't treat myself well. And when they start realizing that and then being kind to their inner critic and soothing their inner critic and bringing soothing practice to themselves in any given moment, I mean, there's so much transformation that happens. So I get so excited because children just take to it. And they, I mean, so on the one hand, we're so worried about, oh, you know, children are in such bad situations and in trauma and there's so many worries, whatever. But in reality, they're so resilient. And their willpower and their willingness to learn, you know, one forgets, you know, what youth is about. It's a movement that's going forward. It's this, you know, they go and they take things on board and they're enthusiastic and they have a will and they just, well, you know, they teach me and they will come up with things, you know, they will share with me, for instance, their music and, you know, and we'll do some mindful dance. That means staying in the moment for the music, not spinning off into another emotion or memory, but coming back in, you know, when it's like surfing or dancing, you know, you've got to have presence to be able to do it. And they have a lot of it. They have a lot of presence and they take it to another level. So I'm always very inspired to work with kids. So I think 15 years ago, there was a movement to really apply these teachings to teachers. And it's been very successful because let's start with the teacher, not with the children. And I say this, and I have this in my life quite often, you know, I have a lot of parents that will come up to me and say, oh, please, why don't you do a course for the children? And I'll instinctively say, well, what about you? Why don't you come on a course? Because ultimately we always want things for others, but what's our capacity? Where are we at?
So just referring that to teachers, it's just that if I, you know, could reach out would be to say, if you're listening to this podcast and you know that this is an area that you might be struggling with, just in terms of connecting to the children, or if you want to find better ways to develop yourself and your own capacity to be more present, to be more connected to what you're teaching and to the children you're teaching, then come along and find a way, you know, to make this happen in your life, because it's out there and it's out there for you. And just be inspired, and hopefully you'll find a course or a person or that's out there that can really help you to develop and cultivate this capacity.
Jenny, thank you so much. That was so inspiring to get your view of mindfulness and to expand our understanding of it. And I think also to see how comfortably mindfulness can coexist with the academic learning that takes place in the classroom.
We now turn to a conversation between Lynn Van't Hoff and myself, Kate and Sandra, to further unpack how we can create a mindful classroom, specifically drawing on the framework of MISC, Mindfulness in Schools Project.
Kaylin, I know you're an occupational therapist with a master's in positive psychology, and part of your dissertation was around self-regulation and the use of mindfulness, the application of mindfulness. But let me start off by asking, Kaylin, what does this word mindfulness mean to you?
That is a great question, because to be honest, mindfulness is such a huge buzzword, and I actually don't even like using it anymore, because what I'm finding with teens specifically, the moment I use the word mindfulness, you actually lose half of them because of our previous experience maybe with it, or the connotations the word implies. Sometimes people have this image of just sitting and being still for days on end. So for me, rather than use words, because it is in itself an experience, and I was trained by Mindfulness in Schools Project, and the symbol we use is a dot B, because it quite literally means pause, full stop, take a breath, pause and be. So it's that transition between all this doing and all this thinking to just stop, land into the present moment, ground your body into the present moment. B can also stand for the body, coming back to the body, home to this moment. A sense of being with your breath, and how to be with this moment as it is. So bringing in this kind of accepting kind attitude. So for me, it's less about the word and more this ability to pause and be. And how in any mindfulness practice, it's the AAA, the ability to be aware that you might need to take a breath, to pause, to notice where your attention is. And the second is to actually anchor into this present moment using whatever sensory experience can help ground us. Because very often our mind is not yet. So another analogy I like to use with kids and teens, they love this. If you say, have you ever read a book and you get to the bottom of a page and you have no idea what you've just read? That's because our mind is just not present. We mind wandering all the time. And there's a stat that says 47% of our time is spent, our awake time is spent mind wandering, which means you're either thinking about the past or you're thinking something about the future, which means for half our lives, we're actually not showing up for. We're not embodied and present. And I think the world needs people that are embodied and present. So the anchoring part is so important to ground our attention in the here and now. And in any mindfulness practice, you'll often say they'll use the breath as that anchor, or sometimes sound or movement. So whatever you use to help bring this attention back to the here and now with an attitude of acceptance and kindness. So mindfulness for me is less about the word and more about this ability to pause and be.
And I suppose for different people, it might mean different things. Other words might link in with mindfulness, such as awareness, flow.
Yes, yeah, flow. Well, I think, so that's quite interesting, because with teens, what I always start off by saying, you know, if you look at flow, any top athlete, they are so at one and they're in their bodies. And they're present, and that's that flow state. And mindfulness although flow and mindfulness are two very distinct terms, mindfulness helps us to get into flow because it's about that ability to pause, be, and really ground yourself in the here and now. And with teams, I think to really unpack it, what excites me about that mindfulness is the neurobiology behind it and what's actually needed in our society in today's world. So maybe to unpack it a bit further, I can use the analogy, I can use three things. What a stick man, and what a character Mr. Daffy, and the third thing, two systems that are inside us, one I call nervous Nelly and peaceful Penny, and what these three things all have in common when it comes to mindfulness. So if you do a stick man, and in my clinical experience, if you get a team to draw an outline of a human figure or a stick man, where do you usually start? The head, right? You start with the head. And very typically, the head's drawn really big. And most often, what I've certainly found, sometimes these teams, they don't even draw shoes, which is quite significant because that shows us that we spend so much time in our heads from the neck up and very often feeling ungrounded, not in our bodies. And that's where Mr. Duffy comes in. There's a book and this character, Mr. Duffy, get his name, says Mr. Duffy lived a little distance from his body. And I think most of us are doing that. We're not inhabiting our bodies. And this is very important because in our bodies, we have two systems. So you have your brain and you have your spinal cord, and that's your central nervous system, which is also composed of two branches, your sympathetic nervous system and your parasympathetic nervous system. And when I talk about the sympathetic nervous system, I'm here talking about the character Nervous Nelly. And this is our ability to constantly react and be on the go. It's what helped our forefathers survive and run from the saber-toothed tiger. And it's we are constantly in this system because it's our stress response, and it helps us remain alert, activated, and aware. And the other is peaceful Penny, and this is our rest and digest parasympathetic nervous system. This is what happened when they were able to escape the saber-toothed tiger or hunt it down, and then they could rest by the fire and chill out. And what's happening in today's world, we are not able to spend enough time in this rest and digest nervous system to help us remain regulated and calm. And mindfulness is really interesting because how we pay attention can actually help us regulate our brains and our bodies. So that's really important for me.
Kaylin, I'm going to ask you something. You were talking about how we pay attention. Can you elaborate a little bit more on the neurology of that?
I think this is the fun part for me because I joke with teams that you're always taught to pay attention. So as a teacher, you can say, you know, we're always telling you to pay attention. But nobody ever really teaches us how to pay attention. Or better yet, play with our attention. Because in mindfulness, or in these dot beats, that's what we're doing. We are playing with our attention, bringing it back to the here and now, using the sensations of the breath or what will ever bring us back to the present moment. And even when it wanders off, we bring it back again. And this ability to sustain our attention in the present moment is really amazing because it can actually change the structure and function of our brains, which is why mindfulness is so interesting and capturing so much attention at the moment, especially in the academic side of it. So with teams, I always compare this to explaining and exploring the nature of your attention, because I think so often, and I think teams are so receptive to teaching them about this amazing instrument in their head, teaching them about their brains. So starting out with that really captures their attention, because if you refer to attention being like a spotlight, being like a torch, you can aim it. You can direct it somewhere where you want to, so you have a choice in how to aim it. And then when you point it somewhere, you zoom in, using that spotlight to zoom in and explore the detail of it and zoom out. You notice something about your attention that you can aim it and you can play with it, sustain it. But as we all know, it's really hard to sustain it for a long time. So using the spotlight of our attention helps teams to understand how mindfulness is training this attention muscle. And this is so critical when it comes to the brain, because this is using this exercise, training the muscle of our attention helps to grow certain neural connections. And this is where I explain to the kids about team brain. So team brain is really exciting because that's also when you get a bit of the guys on board or everyone who likes sports to understand how teams come together. And you really need to have a well-working, integrated team to to score the goals and to function well. And the same is in your brain. And what they're discovering is that when we're practicing bringing our attention back over and over again, certain parts of the brain are really being activated. And now, while this is not all entirely scientifically correct, it does help get the message across. So the first team member that is involved, which Jenny spoke about originally, is the prefrontal cortex, especially the middle prefrontal cortex. It's the front part of the brain here between your eyes. It's the, you know, the last part of our brain ready to develop. Sometimes only fully structurally grows until the age of 25. So kids are allowed the excuse, really, of making poor decisions, because that's what it is. It's really the CEO of our brain. It's that ability to pay attention, to make choices, and to respond skillfully in a way that makes us human and empathically towards others as well. And I like to call this front part of the brain the captain of the brain. And as any captain, you can make up a fun name, as I do with teens, you know, Cappy P. And I even get them to make a pose, because teens love movement, and you've got to get movement going when you're teaching things to help remember. So get them to strike a sort of captain-like pose, you know, if they're putting their arm to their heads. So that's Cappy P. And subcortically, in the lower regions of the brain, you have three other members involved when we're training our attention. And the first is the hippocampus. And I like to call this hippie, or whatever name they want to give it. And hippocampus is really responsible for the memory. And storing a memory is taking in information and storing it. And it's so coupled with emotion as well, because it also sits in the emotion center of the brain. So I explain to kids that just as you remember, you know, scoring that cool hockey goal, and the next time you're playing a hockey match, you'll have that memory of it and you'll be able to score that goal. Just the same, hippie remembers good things and it also remembers the not so good things. So when you get a test back and you just see all the red, the next time you write a test, you'll remember maybe that negative experience, or you'll just see all the red on your paper, and that, you know, hippie reminds us of the not so good times, which is also quite difficult. So coupled with the hippocampus and the memory center, right next to that is the insula, which is a new part of the brain that's been explored. And the insula, I joke with kids, as being like a DJ. And we call it the ins. Because your ins is doing just that. It's picking up on your body rhythms, what's happening in your body right now, helping you to tune in, not just our own bodies, but also understand what other people's might be feeling and going through. So my insula now then is picking up on what you might be feeling without you having even to say anything. It's a very non-verbal experience. So you've got your Cappy P, and then below that team member, you've got hippie and you've got ins. And then right next to hippie is the amygdala. And this is also very important when it comes to mindfulness and being in today's world. And I joke with teens of who likes almonds, those nuts, because the amygdala is the shape of an almond and you've got two of them, one on the left and one on the right. And they sit in these brain regions, and the amygdala, which we call Ami, make up any team name you want to. It's a bit like your siren that's going bee-bah, bee-bah, bee-bah. And you joke, but teens actually, you know, you can bring the silly to the science. So even though it sounds a bit cringy, teens actually love a bit of the animation. And what Ami does, your amygdala, is constantly making you aware of anything that might go wrong. It's constantly on alert to all the threats. It's your siren. So we're so grateful for our amygdalas, because if it wasn't for this part of the brain, we wouldn't have been able to activate that flight, fight, freeze response, and especially a flight from the saber-toothed tiger that was chasing our forefathers. So it's because of Ami that we are actually here today, because it constantly keeps us responsive and reactive to what's happening in our environment. But in today's world, they're not just saber-toothed tigers, they're none at all, but instead, they're cyber-toothed tigers. So a lot in the digital age, and there's so many stresses that teens and even us face on this constant basis. So Ami is constantly firing this bee-bar, bee-bar, which also makes teen brain a bit dysregulated, and it's Cappy, captain of our brain, responsibility to help calm the teen brain down and help us respond instead of react. And that's exactly what we're doing when we are training this muscle of our attention, and we allow ourselves to pause and step into our bodies and into our breath and take this breathing space. We are actually strengthening the neural connections in that prefrontal cortex and captain's region to help calm down the whole of teen brain. And even some studies show in long-term practicing monks who have practiced many hours have actually more gray matter, more neural connections in the prefrontal cortex, and actually less activated amygdalas. So it's quite fascinating that what we're doing through mindfulness and training the spotlight of our attention is helping team brain to really work together to help us function in a way that's most helpful to ourselves and to others. But, and the big bit, what I find the most interesting, in order to even practice training the spotlight of our attention, we need the spotlight to be turned on in the first place. So then by this I mean our bodies. Just as our minds can help calm down our brains and our bodies help to regulate our minds and the spotlight of our attention. This is where it becomes super fascinating. I'm sure teachers will understand. If you just take a typical day in the life of a teacher, you probably haven't had your first cup of coffee, you probably skipped breakfast, so you're not eating right. And you might not have gone to the gym in the last year, so you're feeling a bit sluggish. You might have so many tests due to mark. You might not have had your full 8 hours of sleep for the last 5 years. And most importantly is that, you know, connecting with us and socially is so hard in a world, especially in the digital age. And all these things are so critical for helping our body maintain physiological balance and homeostasis, allowing us to spend less time in nervous Nelly mode, as I previously mentioned, and more time with peaceful ping in that parasympathetic state. So what I mean is, how we eat, what we're eating on the day, are we moving? And this is so important for our teens because movement is critical to help our bodies regulate it. And there's a fun new term called BDNF, which is a brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And every time we move, if our blood's pumping and our heart rate's rising, this factor is released and it goes to our brain and it actually builds new neural connections, new nerve cells, which are really like the roads and the highway systems in our brain that allow all this energy and information to travel through. So we've got to be moving. And in addition to that, you stress, you need just amount of positive stress to help wake our systems up, to help keep us alert and activated, but not too much so that we're overstimulating nervous Nelly. And our bodies do, our sleep is critical. And I think we know this, that when we sleep, we're allowing hippocampus to really store and integrate our memories. We're allowing all the new neural connections to form and grow. That's really, when we're sleeping, is when our brain is most activated. It's really synthesizing everything we've learned during the day. And rest is different to sleep. And I know that teachers think rest is this unicorn term because so many of us struggle to actually rest. And by that, I don't mean Netflix or dulling out. It's really switching from that busy doing mode into just that being space and switching off from all that headspace that's going upstairs inside all that thought traffic. And last but not least, connecting with others socially, not digitally, socially through conversation and play is also so critical to help step more into the parasympathetic nervous system. So we need to be regulated bottom up, if you will, neck down, in order to just turn the spotlight of our attention on. And that's what makes mindfulness, which is such a seemingly simple practice, quite a difficult one. Because if we're not regulated in our bodies, it's very hard to then train this muscle of attention. Because I joke with the teens, the spotlight might be a little bit too dim, sometimes switched off, or sometimes like a disco light. So that brings me to my next point. And I think what is quite interesting, or maybe a misconception, is the role of self-regulation when it comes to mindfulness.
Kevin, yes, that's a fascinating comment that you've made there, because I think there's a lot of confusion between self-regulation and self-control. So maybe you can elaborate on that a little bit.
Yeah, it's a common misconception. So Dr. Stuart Shanker is where I really learned about self-regulation and unpacking it, because we use it so much and we say, oh, we need self-regulation, it's the key strength in the class, but what is it really? And self-regulation is not the same as self-control. Self-control is that ability to inhibit impulses, to make conscious decisions, to delay gratification. Self-regulation is the umbrella term under which self-control falls. So like I mentioned, self-regulation starts in the body, it's biological. So are you biologically regulated? How is your energy in that moment? Are you emotionally regulated? That's our ability to deal with the difficult emotions and the good emotions, to integrate that. And then you get the cortical, social, and prosocial, which is more the self-control, higher brain functions that happen in Captain P's prefrontal cortex. So self-regulation is an embodied presence in a way of regulating. It is both bottom-up and top-down.
That is a fascinating thing for teachers to understand and then to work with, which leads me on to my next question. And that is really some practical applications then in terms of mindfulness and self-regulation that teachers could use in the classroom.
Yeah, I think, so the first thing, and I think Jen mentioned it, you can't fool teens. So to have a mindfulness, or to at least try this experience of what it's like, I'm just going to refer to pause and be, really, to try and step out of this headspace, this thinking, into the sensory being state, is really important, because then you will have a sense of why it's so difficult, or why it can also help ground you in difficult times. So the first thing is, as a teacher, and I myself, you know, even teaching this with teens, I struggle to do those 20-minute or those long practices, because time is really difficult, and I know we need to make time for it. But what I really do, just as a starting place, and if you're a teacher, you can, in your car when you're driving to work, just as you arrive and you park in front of the school, you can set your alarm for 3 minutes. Doesn't have to be, it can be shorter, it can be a little bit longer, and just use that as a breathing space to shift gear from your doing and your thinking into just a space of being. And that gear is an appropriate analogy when you're in the car, because that's really what you're practicing. Can you shift between the doing and the being? So for teachers, that might be a fun first place to start. How can you build in these little daily reminders? And then switching that into the classroom with the teens, because I don't think mindfulness has to be a long practice. I believe that taking it into the class and using it as a way to transition from maybe coming from home into the classroom is a wonderful space, or from break to the classroom. So having short periods where you just create a ritual and a routine of grounding and a pause and be space. But Lynn, I don't know about you, when dealing with teens, and I'm sure other teachers will agree with me, if you start even using the word mindfulness, you've lost half of them, as I mentioned at the beginning. So I think you've got to know your audience. And teenagers, you know, you've got to make mindfulness cool. So starting out by discarding the word to begin with, and more tuning into why would a practice of helping you shift gear from the doing to a more being mode, to being here in this moment, why is it important for them? Why do you think that they might need it? And they will tell you, so you can tap into what, you know, in the MIS program, we first start off with what are the challenges and possibilities you're facing at this age and stage, and, you know, they list it, and it's relationships or stress or exams and sport. And sport's a great one, because this also appeals to especially boys and girls and boys, and I think it's quite a difficult thing, this mindfulness. So sport is great, because you can tap into this flow state. And I know academically flow and mindfulness are different constructs, but to teens it still carries the essence of what we're really doing here, in embodied presence. So I always start with that. We say, okay, who's your favorite athlete? And they'll all tell us, you know, A, what sport they play and who their icons are. And I always use an example like LeBron James, one of many athletes who use mindfulness to help ground them and help create flow states, and stepping into flow to practice that pause and that breathe and that being. So tap into what's relevant for them and who they can relate to and why it's important for them, because it doesn't have to just be about what's wrong, you know, avoiding stress. It's also about what's strong, about how you can cultivate more ways of being in a world that's more nourishing to you and to the others around you. So that's the first thing. And I think the second thing, and I think even in the MIS program that's taught me, is that it's playful. Like I said, you're playing with attention here. So you've got to use humor. I think you've got to use analogies. And I do use multimedia. I use clips to sort of illustrate. There's a funny snowman YouTube video, which you have a person dressed as a snowman that keeps on giving people walking past fright. And then it explains to teens the flight, fright, freeze response. So, you know, really getting them involved in all levels.
I think that's a very important thing for teens, because traditionally mindful practices are quite long, focusing on breathing. So I think what you say is you introduce something that is far more engaging for teens and maybe less threatening if they're watching a video clip, if there's a discussion, if there's a bit of humour, if there are a couple of slides.
Yeah.
And then practices. Am I understanding correctly that's...
I think you're completely right, because maybe I need to backtrack here and say my intention, especially with the MIST program, and I think with teachers too, you're not asking anyone to become mindfulness experts. I mean, we certainly are. All we're doing is dipping our toes in and planting the seeds of what it might be like to really shift gears from this constant frenetic space of doing the nervous nearly to help find a more nourishing way of being in that rest state. So that is why, yeah, so to make it playful, to keep it as surface level as possible, and then slowly start building it in a more appreciative inquiry way. By that I'm meaning, don't, I think with teens, you can't force anything with them. You almost invite them to practice with you. So I think what works well with one teacher, and particularly, she creates in the morning an option. She arrives, which is not ideal for all teachers, but 3 minutes before class starts, and those teens that are around have the option to go into the class and practice the breathing space with her, and it's actually grown organically by that.
Isn't that wonderful? Because that's creating the idea of a quiet space in a school, and schools are traditionally very busy, constantly busy and constantly noisy. So for the introverts, amongst the children, that must be quite a relief to have that option.
Absolutely.
That's a lovely example, then, of a quiet space in a school. You talked a little bit earlier about movement as well. Do you want to talk a little bit about mindful walking and how it could be used in school?
Yeah, mindful walking is really interesting, because that just, it's an immediate way of tuning into, you know, what's happening, what are you feeling underneath your feet? And I think nature in itself helps us immediately step into the present moment. I heard recently that there was a group of school kids, actually, that, again, you know, kids are dropped off normally a little bit before school starts oftentimes. And one girl in particular started a little walking club where they get together and they just walk before school starts around the school field, so it's safe. So you could even create a little mindful walking contagion. And mindful walking really is about bringing a strong silence, I think, to a practice if you are with people, and a way of just tuning into all the sensations around you. So really feeling your feet, the heel toe as it touches the grass beneath you, feeling your feet and your socks and your shoes. I always do a challenge with teens when I do a sort of nature walk or a mindful walk, and really ask them again that pause and be anchoring into that sensing mode of how many different sounds did they hear, how many different things did they see that they haven't noticed before, what did the air smell like? That's a strange question, but it really helps them to just tune in to the present moment. So mindful walking is a great one. I think also it's beyond, I think something so crucial to mention is that there's so many what's. You can do mindful walking, mindful eating, mindful breathing. There's a whole array of what, and I think that's really up to what you as a teacher feel most comfortable with, what you've tried and what works for you. Because as I said, kids pick up on something. If you don't feel right with it, you won't be able to really carry it across. What's more critical for me is establishing the ritual of a pause and be during a school day. And I think, Lynn, for many kids and teens coming into school, this is the one place of consistency for them. A lot of them are coming from not one but two different homes, and things are very busy. And you arrive at school, and if you are setting up some sort of space where they know there's no expectations, because school and the rest of the school day is full of expectations, having to perform and do well in tests and perform in the sports field, etc., and even in friendships. If you are able to create one space where there are no expectations, it's just an opportunity for them to just come back home to this moment, home to their bodies, and cultivate that loving attention. That is profound, because what you're doing is you're creating a ritual and a sense of consistency and predictability in a world that is so uncertain. So it's less about the what and more about bringing in those micro moments of being able to pause, be, and land.
It is a wonderful place to end the discussion, because I think what you're saying is so profound, that if we have pockets of opportunity to create safe spaces
in a world that is so unpredictable and uncertain, schools are the ideal place, and that can go such a long way in alleviating some of the mental health symptoms that are so widespread today.
We now speak to Ingrid Pienaar, who is a middle school teacher and really has done wonders in applying mindfulness in her own unique way in the class.
So, welcome, Ingrid.
And thank you.
I know that you have done your own mindfulness training. You completed an 8-week program. You try and apply it, like all of us, as and when you've got time. But I was wondering, having completed this program, obviously having gained an understanding of mindfulness, just to start off by asking if you feel this has impacted on your teaching, on who you are and how you approach the children in your classroom.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the main thing that I've gained as a person in general is just a greater awareness of myself, but also that when things are stressful and difficult, that I can kind of step back a little bit and be aware that there's more to life than this little moment. I mean, recently I had a moment where I really messed up at school and I lost a very important document, and I was feeling so stressed, I was almost blacking out from panic that I'd done this thing, and I had my mindfulness facilitator's voice in my head saying, "So what?" Because that's what she would always say when we said, "Oh, I'm late and it's terrible." She'd say, "So what? You know, you messed up. So what? Move on. You know, deal with it, absorb it, and then move on." And that's been hugely transformative, I think, in the way that I handle stressful situations, especially as a teacher and as a first year teacher, because there's just so much that is stressful every day. But I'm able to contextualize that. And then in terms of how I approach teaching and the children, I think it's just, it's allowed me to understand them differently. I think it's allowed me to be more patient, because the same patience I try to apply to my own life and to myself, and the kindness that I try to give myself every day, I give to them as well. And especially focusing on their actions not being markers of their misbehavior or disobedience, but of a moment that they're having, an experience they're having. Yeah, and that's really changed, I think. Well, it's hard to say changed, because it's my first time coming in, but it's really impacted, I think, the way that I engage with my very lovely young people.
Ingrid, you've touched on such an important part of mindfulness, and that is compassion. And I love the way you're talking about how you're able now to show more compassion towards yourself, as well as a more compassionate understanding of the adolescents in your classroom. I mean, using that and developing that, what would you say your aim has been in starting to introduce mindfulness into the classroom?
That's really interesting, because it really has developed more into a kind of mindfulness that's focused on compassion over time. Because initially, first year teacher, I have very well behaved classes by South African standards, but still I've got some very bouncy kids, some very bouncy characters in all my classes, but especially one class. And I thought to myself, oh my goodness, what do I do? And one day, on the spur of the moment, I just had them close their eyes and breathe, because I was just feeling like, I don't know what to do right now. Maybe I could just take a moment to gather myself well and just get them to calm down. So it started off being much more about maybe this will make them less naughty, you know, kind of a kind of instrumental usage of mindfulness. And then I had quite an amazing moment about, I think, a month into my teaching these kids. We went on a camp, and one of my very bounciest boys said to me on camp in the evening, he said, "Ma'am, can we do stargazing again?" Because on the first night I'd done a couple minutes, well, actually it ended up being about half an hour meditation, and I called it stargazing because I have been shying away from using the word mindfulness. I don't want to, or meditation, I don't want to put them off for thinking, oh, that's for sissies or whatever. So I've kind of tricked them maybe into taking part. And so I, on the first night, I'd had them just lie on their backs and look at the stars. It was
incredibly hot, and they'd all fallen asleep. Unfortunately, then they'd woken up again when I had to put them to bed. So on the second night, this very bouncy, enthusiastic, but very rebellious little character said to me, ma'am, are we going to do stargazing again? And I was so surprised because I realized that he really had benefited from it and enjoyed it. And from then on, I did it more and more often. When we got back to school, we started doing it almost daily. I tried to do it daily at the beginning of a lesson when I see them, or sometimes if it's after break, I just do it again anyways, because they come in so all over the place. It just really helps to start the lesson off together and calmly, whereas they come in really frazzled often after break and really very, very hyperactive. And so there still is that element for me of, I guess it's a little bit instrumental because it really does calm them down, but it's developed into so much more, especially our early morning grounding. We call it a grounding session, and it's become much more about giving the kids a space and a chance to connect with themselves and how they're feeling at the start of the day. And I encourage them to try and find a time to check in with themselves later. Unfortunately, I can't see them later, otherwise I would do that with them and just try and remind them, this is how you felt this morning and how do you feel now. And we've got a system at school. You were talking about self-regulation, Kaylin, and we have a system where we're supposed to, where they're supposed to recognize whether they're feeling green, A-okay, ready to go, blue, a little bit sad or slow, yellow, a little bit crabby, anxious, on edge, or red, completely, you know, ready to explode. Exactly. But it hasn't often been... I haven't often known how to use it. And so what I do now is during the little meditation, I'll ask them just with their eyes closed to give me a thumbs up to show which color they're in. And preceding that, I get them to try and locate their feelings and just empathize with themselves for a moment, and always reminding them to accept those feelings without judgment, but to move ahead with the day, knowing this is how they feel, but to make good choices for their state of mind and state of heart as they are at that moment. And it's been really interesting to see how more and more children are actually giving me signals, because at first I think not all of them knew what color they were in. Well, they didn't really know what they were feeling, how to describe it. And every day I see more and more in the blue and yellow, actually, and fewer in the green, depending on the day. Some days are very, very green days. Some kids who would tell me if I ask them, oh, no, I'm fine, are actually indicating to me, actually, I'm not so fine. And that's not, I don't think, a traditional use of mindfulness meditation. But for me as a teacher, it's very useful just to be able to actually check in and know more or less how these kids are doing now in the morning. And I can use that as a launching platform to remind them to be kind to themselves and to one another. And that's where the compassion comes into, because from that point and knowing that many of them are giving me the signal that they're yellow or blue, that many other people are feeling like that too, and we need to be mindful of the space we're creating, a space of mutual respect, so that the way we move forward in the lesson is not a way that's going to disturb or upset anyone else.
That is actually wonderful, because that is a combination of the integral part of mindfulness, which is compassion, linking in with, I think, a specific OT strategy or practice of the alert program. Yeah.
If I may,
can I ask Kaylin to...
The zones of... Ingrid, what you were talking about just made me smile. Because that's it. I think what you were tuned into, again, coming back to the body, and I think that kids aren't inhabiting that, or like you said, they'll say they're fine, but they're actually not even aware of how their body is. And those colors originated from an alert program, because to distinguish where your body is, they're called the engine program, actually, with little kids, but I use it with teens, because, and actually even I use it with myself, because it's almost a nonverbal way of checking in, what's the weather pattern like in my body right now? And I find that profound. And, you know, the blue can either be that sleepy, tired, low battery state. And like you're saying, that yellow is that sort of hyper aroused. It can even be excited or it can be anxious. And then like you're, that red is that like flip lid, don't come near me state, which I'm sure some of them also can be in. And I think that green is that just right zone. And so I love doing that, because when you're taking a pause and be, you're actually checking in, where am I right now? And then what I love is you take it one step further and you're saying, okay, like, let's locate that emotion, because then, as we always say, the body remembers what the mind forgets. So you're actually asking them in the Dan Siegel's way to name it, to tame it. And I love the way you did that, because you're doing it with this is how it is. You know, you don't have to change it, but just being able to acknowledge what you're feeling right now, to be able to name it and to just hold it. And that you can be with it, you know, especially with the stormy emotions. Lynn and I, we looked out the window once, and, you know, I think it's a monkey's wedding. You know, when it rains and the sun comes in, maybe mindfulness is about holding that with that sort of gentle kindness. You can hold both. So I really like that breakdown and then creating that space.
And how wonderful, I think, Ingrid, what you're saying is that you're using these techniques, these strategies on an incidental basis during the school day. And isn't that really the answer for so many teachers who might be listening to this, that it can be done on this basis very effectively?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it can be very quick if it needs to be. And if there's some time, it can be much longer. And it's been amazing to see how children can sustain their attention during those times. I mean, I don't know what's going on in their heads, and that's fine. I don't have to know, but I can see, casting my gaze over the room, that some of the jumping knees are settling, some of the fidgety fingers are just going a little bit more slowly, and it's, some kids still don't like to do it and they don't like to take part. I just require them to sit quietly so that everyone else can do it. Slowly but surely, more kids join in, and I can just see even these little moments, little stolen moments, they get used to it. And it becomes the more you do it, the better it gets. It's the more often we do it. I just say, I start off by saying, okay, take a deep breath, and everyone already gets ready. And I used to say, plant your feet flat on the ground, your bum flat on your chair, and make your spine, try to make your spine quite straight. And I don't have to say that anymore, because we've done it so many times that now I just say, okay, take a deep breath and allow your eyes to fall closed, and they just all kind of settle themselves into a comfortable but alert position and are ready for it, which has been awesome to see.
I love that. In the MISS program, we have the practice called the Fofbok, the feet on floor, bum on chair. And it slowly goes into this automatic sort of embodied presence.
Oh. It's so interesting to hear how the things that I've been doing spontaneously link into established programs, because it's really just been out of necessity that I've been doing this stuff, not with much training, training at all.
Well, what a wonderful opportunity it's been to be able to link the occupational therapy practice to the daily practice in the classroom. Ingrid, to go back to what you were saying a little earlier in the conversation, I mean, you are really modeling and co-regulating with the children when you're with them, and bringing compassion and acceptance to your interaction with them. But what you mentioned earlier was that you're doing this out of necessity. Do you want to elaborate a little bit more on that?
Sure. So in terms of necessity, what I mean is I've really just been noticing and hearing from a lot of the children that they really just are so very anxious. And a lot of the parents email me and let me know, or come to meet me and say, can you talk to my child? They're so anxious. They're so worried at school and at home about all sorts of things. And the parents are very confused most of the time about these emotions that maybe they haven't tapped into themselves. And one of the things I've also noticed about our grade is they're at this age where they're skeptical of one another and are gossiping a lot and aren't sharing a lot of love amongst one another. Even if they are very good friends, there's a lot of, I think, self-consciousness in being 12, 13, 14. It's a hard age to be. It really is very difficult. And so I think I felt a little bit embarrassed the first time I did it, but then when I saw how trusting their acceptance of the words that I was saying was, I just repeated it again, especially during exam times. During the meditation, I'll just say to the kids, and give yourself a little hug. Remember that you are inherently valuable because you are yourself, and that I love you, and that you love you, and all your friends love you. And no matter what happens in the next hour, you're valuable and powerful and important. And in different, that's the kind of summary of all the different things I might say to them. But I've just felt it necessary to say this to them because I don't think they're necessarily hearing it very often. And like I say, I was a bit embarrassed the first time I started saying it because I thought, oh, they're going to squirm in their seats. You know, they've got their eyes closed, but they can still smirk or something. But they just accept the words I'm speaking to them so openly. And I think, and I've never asked them what they think about what I'm saying, because I don't think it's so very important what they, you know, for me, that would be me seeking affirmation. You know, is it okay? Is it okay what I'm doing? But I feel that it's working, and that we all need to be told and to know that we are inherently valuable and that we're loved.
And it almost, it almost links back to what you're saying, Ingrid. It's less about mindfulness, more about heartfulness.
Yeah.
And I think that there's something beyond the words, is there's this deep trust in what you're saying.
Yeah.
Because I feel like that's critical.
Yeah.
And isn't it wonderful if heartfulness can extend from the OT therapy room, the work you do, Kaylin, with adolescents and, you know, that difficult tween age, that the links from a therapeutic environment to an occupational therapy environment and then spread through into the classroom.
Yes, important in the classroom. Yeah.
So wonderful for children to have that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would like to thank you both coming through this afternoon and for sharing your amazing wisdom, but more than that, your wonderful compassion and acceptance. So many thanks.
Thanks.
Ingrid, you mentioned that you get the kids to do some grounding and some settling and, you know, sit in an upright, dignified way. Can you maybe just talk us through one of the grounding exercises that you do?
Sure. So they're so spontaneous that I'm going to have to think to know what it is I really do every day. But I think this is more or less how it would go. So I'm going to speak as if I'm speaking to my kids at school.
Mm-hmm.
So take a deep inhalation. And on your next exhalation, allow your eyes to fall closed. Make sure your feet are nice and flat on the ground so you're connecting with the earth. Your bum is firmly planted on the seat. And try to stack your spine so that your hips and your ribs and your shoulders and your head are kind of in line so that you feel comfortable but upright. And let's just start by taking a deep breath with a loud exhalation, and another deep breath, and a loud exhalation. Now this time, take a very deep breath, and try to control your exhalation as it goes out, making it as smooth and long and slow as you can. Just take a couple deep breaths in your own time, trying to lengthen your inhalations and your exhalations every time, just slowing down. Now, I want you to just try and focus your attention on your fingertips. Just without doing anything, without moving them, just try to focus on the feeling that's already there in your fingertips. Maybe you can feel the coolness of the air from the window. Maybe there's a slight tingling, or maybe you can feel the texture of your sleeve. Maybe you can't feel anything at all, and that is completely fine. You don't have to feel anything. It's just pay attention to whatever sensations are already. Now let's swoop our attention into our heads. Can you identify what your thoughts feel like right now? Maybe they're swirling around. Maybe you've got lots to think about. Maybe you're feeling quite slow and stodgy this morning. Maybe there's not much thought going on at all. Whatever it is, just try and recognize
what it feels like inside your head right now. And then let's slide our attention down into our chests or throat, maybe your stomach or your shoulders, wherever it is that you feel your feelings. And once you've found this place, whether it's your chest or your throat, try to identify what it is you're feeling. If it's a heaviness or a lightness, perhaps you've got a tight feeling in your body, or a looseness. Maybe you can't identify any feeling in particular at all, and that is also completely fine. There's no obligation to feel anything at all. But if you do feel something, try, without wishing it away or judging it, or wishing it were different, just to accept it for a moment, just to recognize how it is that you do feel right now. Then I'll usually ask, I'll mention the colors. I'll ask, are you feeling green? Are you feeling ready to go? A-okay? Everything's fine? Maybe you're feeling yellow. Give me a thumbs up if you're in the yellow space, which is just a little bit anxious, a little bit under the weather, just not quite green. Maybe you're feeling a bit blue today. Maybe you're a bit sad. Maybe you're feeling a little bit sick. Maybe you're just feeling a bit slower than usual. Anyone who's feeling blue, just give me a thumbs up. And if you're feeling red, if you're really feeling on edge, like you might burst into tears, or you really just need some space, just give me a thumbs up. Let's take another deep breath. And a loud exhalation. And a deep breath. Feel your belly filling up with air and your lungs tightening, and really let it out in a controlled stream for as long as you can, and then open your eyes.
We'd like to thank you for joining us on this podcast, and we hope that it's given you some key actionable insights that you can take with you into the class. And a big thank you for Jenny Canyon for sharing your overview of mindfulness and how mindfulness can be applied in the classroom. Thank you to Ingrid Pina for helping us understand how that actually looks on a day-to-day basis. If you'd like to understand a little bit more about how to create your own classroom curriculum around teaching mindfulness, please don't hesitate to contact us directly at Positive Education, or perhaps visit Jenny Canyon's website, or even the Mindfulness at Schools project website. This will hopefully give you some ideas on how to get started. Thank you again for listening. Until next time, goodbye. If you'd like to understand more about creating a mindfulness curriculum teaching kids about mindfulness, please don't hesitate us at Positive Education, or you can go visit the website Mindfulness in Schools Project, or check out Jenny Canyon's website to give you an idea around how to do this. We thank you again for listening, and until next time, goodbye.